Okay, we move on now. You know, redevelopment in urban communities is often thought of as a collaboration between politicians, architects, and neighborhoods. But what if that collaboration included representation from the arts and culture communities? That's the subject of a program launched a few years ago by the Pulitzer Arts Foundation and Washington University's Sam Fox School of Design and Visual Arts. It's called Pixtl and draws upon creative entities to help fashion urban change. With me in studio are Chicago-based designers Amanda Williams and artist Andres Luis Hernandez. They're involved in the Pixtl program and are here to explain how it's different and how it works. They call their part of the project Away, Away, Listen to What I Say. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
I've had a hard time getting my arms around this project, trying to fully and you're both nodding like you understand why. Andres, let me start with you. Explain it to me, if you will, so that I can finally understand what all you're up to.
Sure. So good afternoon. Thanks for having us on.
Pleasure.
So I think our iteration of the Pixtl project is only the second time around, and so I think there's a lot for us to actually dig into as prior iterations of it. From the very beginning, we were very interested and invested in the idea of unbuilding. So we're both trained as architects, have practiced as architects as well, but also now practice as artists. And we were very interested in not actually making the sort of temporary pavilion that you typically get from most creative placemaking projects. For us, we wanted to test out in real time this concept of unbuilding, right? We're seeing our cities unbuild, particularly urban areas, constantly being unbuilt over time, whether through urban renewal or just sort of the buildings sort of begin to fall apart, need to come down. And so for us, we saw it as an opportunity to actually use it as a platform to discuss like what's happening in cities, but also potentially harvest materials from other projects to actually give life to new projects. And so Away, Away, Listen While I Say is actually sort of stop motion in some degree, really kind of playing out the process of unbuilding, right? So, and also thinking about how to shine a light on what happens after a building is gone, right? So once the 3721 Washington building had come down, we're actually involved now in working with contractors and other folks to harvest bricks, clean bricks, and then also begin to kind of push those bricks back out into the city for other projects.
Okay, let's back up a little bit, Amanda, and talk about that building in Washington. That's the former Bruno David Gallery building, correct? And you've been working on that now for a few days. Where are you in that? And just give me a little more detail as to the various phases that you go through to make this happen.
So we had five phases that we sort of identified as this way, as Andres said, to do this stop motion of this unbuilding of the subtraction process. So the first was the marking. And so it was at one moment sort of signaling the end, but also a beginning in a certain sort of way. So we painted the building.
Okay, that's just identifying the building. This is where we're starting kind of thing?
This is where we started, right?
Okay,
sort of marking
okay.
and announcing this beginning of this end. Mm. And then the next phase would be subtraction, which is the actual demolition or removal of the building itself. We're currently midway through translating, which is where we're then taking that material and preparing it for its next life. So very layman's terms, stacking. Harvesting, cleaning the bricks so that they're ready for this kind of next phase. And then there'll be a shaping of that land where the building and then also the Pixtl site is, and then the healing. And so in all of these, they sort of follow a trajectory also of moments where either people are keenly aware of a building going away or maybe collapse these very important segments or these sections that actually have to happen. So something like right now where the site is a pile of bricks, right? And those bricks are then translating into these kind of almost like modules or these pallets of stacked and clean bricks is something that we take for granted or maybe don't even notice in this process, especially in St. Louis, where you have a lot of unsanctioned harvesting and salvaging of the bricks. And so to understand that there's this process that allows for this translation to happen, but also to just give pause and give people an opportunity to stop and have a point of conversation around things that they either take for granted or that maybe they share. If you've experienced a tornado or a hurricane or a flood or a natural disaster, or you are part of an area that has succumbed to eminent domain, or like, there's a variety of reasons why something has to go away. But then what are these kind of shared moments where we can come together to not only whether gain comfort or to share stories, but also maybe think about potentials of different ways that these processes could actually happen.
Andres, that's what I wanted to get to. Once the building is gone and the bricks are gone, and they're probably going to New Orleans, by the way, because that's where St. Louis bricks
goes
do go.
Quite frequently, right? They follow the river.
So you've got a vacant property and actually adjacent vacant properties. What then? You want to put something on that property, don't you, to redevelop?
No, I think for us that's the moment we've been fighting against from the very beginning. And just one small correction for us, these bricks are actually staying in town. So where they typically do get shipped off somewhere else, we're trying to keep as many of those as we can and keep those in town for other projects. But to your point, so as Amanda said, in the shaping phase, we're actually, pretty much most of that Washington corridor is hardscape, and so we're actually now healing that land through an addition of a new greenscape where the building formerly was, and then so we're actually going to kind of heal that area through some siding, some small scale sort of I forgot the word now.
Regrade.
Right, regrade. I'm sorry. We've been talking all morning, so I forgot those were my terms. We were regrading the site, re-sodding, and then the bricks themselves are now, we're seeing that process live, and then eventually those will be kind of pushed somewhere else. I think it opens up a possibility of what could go there. There's already construction happening in the Washington corridor now from the construction of the parking garage. There's the sort of green space that's also
next to
the Sheldon as well. I think for us, it opens up an opportunity for institutions and the city to think about what could happen there as well. I think for us, as we resisted as architects to put something there to actually fill in the gap, I think we've created a new gap that eventually will help kind of create possibilities for that corridor.
I've seen some pictures, some photographs of some of the work that has been done along these lines, and you mentioned marking as being a friend. This involves the painting of the buildings, correct?
Yes.
And that the purpose of that is just to draw attention to the public that something is going on here?
So there's a few ways in which that can happen. So in this particular instance, I think the selection of the color we painted the building gold was to not necessarily only draw attention, but to also use it again as a touchstone to say, what do we value and when? What do we? How do we make associations of value with placemaking, physical buildings? But there are a variety or host of other projects that have used paint on structures in similar ways. So I was actually the author of a project in Chicago that was calling attention to sort of inequities and blight on the south side of Chicago using a color palette related to that. There have been projects in Pittsburgh and in Detroit and in a lot of places where you see these kind of urban conditions, and the color is used for very different things. In Detroit, there's a group called 3D that would use the orange to sort of incite the demolition, to get these things that were dangerous to be removed. So the color can have a kind of variety of reasons. For this particular purpose, I think it was to mark that something was going to happen, but also, again, use it as a moment for people to have conversations about, should this be going away? Are there other ways we can think about structures? We know the raising of Pruitt-Igoe happened many decades ago, but with this kind of new genesis, right, it's a continual conversation, not just in St. Louis, but around the country in these kinds of areas. And so as people who are trained as architects and we're trained to think that we should come in at a moment where there's a tabula rasa, what's a way to actually honor the end of the life cycle, not the beginning? And I think that's the question we have. We don't have the answer always, but that's the question.
But Andres, both of you are architects. What I would be expecting from architects are plans to build something.
Sound like our professors, right?
Right. Right. Well, I think I was laughing with Amanda a couple of weeks ago, and we're kind of changing a little bit of this John Cage statement. One of our mantras right now is we have nothing to build and we are building it. And so I think that's also interesting to think about. In some ways, it's just as much energy that goes into unbuilding and not making something as it does into actually building something. Mm-hmm. I want to just come back really quickly, too, to the marking stage. because I think there's also something that was that may be missing in terms of the folks who saw the aftermath as opposed to the people that participated in the project, right? And so for us, too, it's about having people come out and be engaged and actually caring for this building, right? Here's something that people have walked past, driven past, been inside of for exhibitions, but actually hadn't understood the quality of the brick. And so while we're out there painting, people are talking about all the details they saw in the building, about how soft the brick was in certain areas, or I never noticed the grade change. And so it was also that it wasn't about spectacle. I think that's important, that we didn't we didn't paint this building gold as a public spectacle, but it really was about the kind of care and attention for detail and also spending time with the project.
But, you know, it would seem to me if your objective is to show people what's going on and what can be done, that people watch something. It's like Future Shock, if you remember that book. Suddenly nothing is there or very little is there, and people in neighborhoods want to see something there, don't they?
I think they do want to see something there, but I think as we're both Southsiders in Chicago and growing up in this landscape of seeing nothing there all the time and choosing professions that we thought would help make something there, you realize that it's an extremely complex process in which maybe we need a different approach to the answer. So for 20 years, my answer was, if I could just, you know, draw it and get someone to build it, then it would fix it, right? And so now you realize that there are other opportunities to think about ways that people can have individual or collective agency on smaller scales, right? So obviously there are policy changes that could be made, or there could be newer strategies in the ways developers think about whole areas. But as individuals, as a neighborhood, as a block club, are there ways that you can start spearheading an understanding of other potentials of vacancy besides building? So even if that's for 5 years before another project comes, or even if that's for the 6 months before the permit process happens or the weather changes, right? What are these other ways we can think of? And especially places like St. Louis, where we have such a richness of the material itself, what's the potential of the raw material? Because these things were individual components that came together to be this building for 100 years or however long. They've now gone back to their raw state. What are the other potentials for these materials? And can we kind of systematize or think of a new way to have either industry or a shared economy around the materials, not just the site itself, right? That always seems to be the end point or the focal point.
Can you give me, Andreas, some examples of what you've done with these materials that you've harvested, if I can use that term?
You should use that term. Well, right now we're in the process of translating. And so we're literally just at a point where we're cleaning the bricks. Well, we're not cleaning them, but the bricks are being cleaned, sorted. Yeah, so shout out to Refab for helping with the project with the kind of the sorting and harvesting of the bricks. So, but our idea now is to, once these are palleted, there's sort of two pieces that are going into this. So they're... some of the bricks are actually going to the next door neighbor who has had a neighbor at 3721 the whole time he's owned his property, but now that property is gone, he has no enclosure or sort of edge to his site. And so some of the bricks are actually going to build that. And I think, you know, that's exciting because it also, he's just as much as a partner in this project as some other people that we're working with. The other pallets are, we're actually working to, and it hasn't been announced yet, so I'm not sure what we can and can't say. But yeah, we're working on a request for partners to actually to propose projects across the city that could use this, plus Amanda and I are personally sort of seeding this with a financial gift as well. So we're both sort of gifting these pallets to folks that might need these or want these for certain projects, and then we're also providing sort of seed monies for that.
Amanda, that I understand, and it makes a lot of sense, and that's there are a lot of bricks that come out of a building like this. Well, I was kind of thinking of examples in other cities where you've done this sort of thing. I mean, like the hardware inside a building, the doorknobs, if you will, the plumbing, copper, whatever we're talking about. What do you do with that kind of thing?
So it's actually becoming increasingly popular to have these sort of salvage or resalvage places that allow materials from these buildings to be harvested, and that the idea of deconstruction as opposed to demolition, that there's a very different kind of process. We all know, though, that a lot of times, like you said, a lot of these bricks go down in New Orleans, or they're the cool, you know, inner wall for the microbrewery in the hip part of town, right? And so I think that's also an interest of ours to say, we really have to think about how to systematize this or how to streamline this process so that it can be affordable, so that if we know this is happening all the time, what are ways we can shift the wrecking industry, the you know, people that understand chain, you know, supply chain and demand, to help make the process of cataloging, or the internet is a great resource for now getting information out to people who need that exact cornice or this sort of stone, or, and so that it's not such a specialized sort of elite operation, right? That it could be streamlined. And we are both educators and work a lot with young people, and it'd be fantastic to have an understanding of architecture, construction, placemaking that has to do with becoming experts on, you know, we were just out at the site and saw six different bricks from historic brick manufacturers, right? Like, that's a history that's just as important as knowing how to draft in CAD or 3D rendering, or, you know, all the things that get emphasized in these capacities. Like, what are ways in which we can take this process that we've kind of slowed down and made public and streamline them so that they aren't just this specialized thing that either the copper's being stolen and sold on the black market, or these, like you're saying, these turrets or these very specialized elements are being used in other very special components. What's a way to really get our arms around the fact that this is a nationwide sort of phenomenon, right? That these things, these buildings are reaching a certain age across the country because of the moment of industrial revolution, or because of the river, or because of the Midwest is this place for stone and brick and, you know, all these materials. These buildings are reaching the age at the same time, and there's a variety of reasons why they are being turned into other things in terms of their raw material, right? So how do we really get ahead of that, right? And not just assume that the only thing that can happen is that it goes to a dumpster or it goes mm-hmm. to a project that can afford it.
Mm-hmm. Less than 2 minutes left. Andres, okay. I want to come back to you with the question is, what can we expect to see in the 3700 block of Washington 2 years from now, 5 years from now?
Possibility.
Good
no,
answer.
No, I'm sure there the institutions in that corridor, I know we already know that the Grant Center, the nonprofit organization there, has ideas of what to happen and sort of attract. I'm hoping that we'll see more art projects happening as well. I'm hoping we'll see foot traffic as well in a different way than only vehicular traffic. And that may or may not come through our project. It'll hopefully come from someone else's project as well. But I think that the future is potentially stasis as well, that it may actually look like it looks 2 years from now, but 20 years from now may be different prognosis, right? And I think that's important. That I think this idea of waiting, and sort of there's an anxiousness around getting to the thing that's
aeration.
Built. But it actually might take it might take us sort of, to Amanda's point of aerating, to sort of turn over the soil and turn over what's happening to make it actually more fertile for future projects.
This is a pretty hot section of town, though. I would expect that any real estate is going to be looked at
yes.
and coveted.
Yeah.
No, I think you're exactly right. But I think it falls on artists and it falls on arts institutions to also just provide the framework to have other kinds of conversations, or at least visually, literally present that there are alternatives. So like you're saying, in the end, real estate obviously, you know, often rules the day, but green spaces are important, open space, landscape architecture. There are other valuable uses to corridors that are about culture or about communal activity that don't have to have structures.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. All we'll
right.
be watching Pixtel and the project in the weeks and months ahead and years ahead. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amanda Williams and Andres Hernandez. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
We change directions now because we have a comment from Nancy Kranzberg, who offers these thoughts on hats as art.
Hats off to the St. Louis Art Museum for presenting Degas, Impressionism, and the Paris Millinery Trade. When I think of Degas, I think of young dancers, but this exhibition is the first one to explore Degas' fascination with the subject of millinery. The museum calendar booklet described the exhibition as focusing on the intersection between the artist's avant-garde work and a remarkable golden age in the history of millinery in Paris in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The museum's description of the exhibition says that during this time, there were around 1,000 millinery shops in the French capital, with milliners creating extravagantly trimmed hats in a wide range of materials, including silk, velvet, felt, artificial flowers, and bird plumage. This exhibition focuses on women's millinery, but there's also a section on men's hats that examines the ubiquity of the top hat, bowler, and boater in Parisian male fashion and the picturing of these subjects by Degas, Toulouse-Lautrec, Morisot, and others. There are hat museums around the world, such as the one in Portland, Oregon, and the Victoria and Albert Museum in London has an incredible collection of hats. Our own Missouri History Museum, according to Shannon Meyer, senior curator, has more than 700 hats in its collection. Shannon Meyer also says hats were a very important part of fashion, particularly for women, because their size and trimmings were a good indicator of social status. Some of my favorite hats and bonnets in the collection have exotic feathers of entire birds on them. During the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the popularity of feathers and whole birds in millinery contributed to the decline of several species. The development of the Audubon Society helped to put a stop to the killing of birds for the sake of fashion. An article on the internet talks about the most famous works of art with hats in them. On the list are Van Eyck's portrait of Giovanni Arnolfini, who was wearing a typical merchant's summer hat, and in Rembrandt's An Old Man in Military Costume, the man wears a 1630 plumed hat consisting of an ostrich feather standing proud against a velvet cap. Helena Sheffield, in her brief History of Hats, or The Art of Wearing Hats, says the earliest headpiece ever discovered comes from 3300 B.C. She cites some significant dates, such as 800 A.D., when St. Clement, patron saint of hatters, accidentally invented felt, leading the way for milliners. She also notes that the term milliners comes from the high fashion in Milan. Young Anna Zeitlin, who is a milliner in Nashville, Tennessee, and has her own business, says, "Hats are a great way to express your individual style. There's been a great resurgence of hats in recent years, thanks partly to the royal wedding. Fashion has become more democratized. It's all about individualism. Hats are often worn by those representing different religions, such as the yarmulke worn by some Jews, veiling in many Christian religions, different head coverings worn by Muslims, and the Amish and Mennonites advocate that women should wear head coverings at all times. I haven't even mentioned crowns, helmets, or sports hats, or all the songs such as In Your Easter Bonnet from Easter Parade and Merle Haggard's My Own Kind of Hat, or Dr. Seuss's Cat in the Hat, or Red Riding Hood. Get your coat and get your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Oop, wrong season. Off to buy a sun hat for summer. I'm Nancy Kranzberg.
Nancy Kranzberg has been involved in the arts community for more than 30 years on numerous arts-related boards. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Colin Mueller, Monica Ramirez, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Arts and culture programming on St. Louis On the Air is funded in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.